From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's Duke Ellington's E. St. Louis Toodaloo. This week, the late composer was honored with a special Pulitzer Prize. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature interviews with two of this year's Pulitzer winners. A. Scott Berg won for his biography of Charles Lindbergh. John McPhee won for his book Annals of a Former World, about the geological history of North America. And we'll hear Maureen Corrigan's review of the book that won in the fiction category, The Hours, by Michael Cunningham. Also, John Powers reviews two new French films, The Dream Life of Angels and I Stand Alone. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, Scott Berg won a Pulitzer Prize for his biography of Charles Lindbergh. On this archive edition, we have an interview with Berg recorded last September, just after the book's publication. He describes Lindbergh as the first modern media superstar. Lindbergh is most famous for two things. He became a hero in 1927 when he made the first successful flight across the Atlantic, and he became a victim in 1932 after his infant son was kidnapped and killed in what was called the crime of the century. Over the years, Lindbergh and his family worked hard to protect their privacy. Before his death in 1973, he stipulated that his papers should remain private until 50 years after the death of his widow, Anne Morrow Lindbergh. But she was so impressed with Scott Berg, she gave him access to her husband's papers and her own. I asked Scott Berg to describe why Lindbergh's transatlantic flight was so remarkable in 1927.
This was, well, not only was it a fantastically long way to go in a short time. I mean, not only was this the greatest demonstration to date of what aviation could do, but this was really the first moment in which a single human being left the Earth. There was no contact with this one human being. Again, Columbus, many thought, was gonna just float off the edges of the Earth. But he was not alone. Lindbergh was out there alone. And there was that period where he had flown up from, he left from Roosevelt Field in Long Island. He went up to the coast of Canada. And then for about 15 hours, he was flying into just black night, terrible weather, and he was out of visual and audio contact with every human being on Earth. So this, in that moment, he was suddenly elevated to godlike status. And then 15 hours later, he is spotted for the first time coming over Ireland and rejoining the human race. And, of course, by the time he did actually land at Le Bourget in Paris, he did become a god in that instant. So it was an act of great, great heroism. It was death-defying, and he pulled it off. And above and beyond that, it was scientifically a wonder in that he who had lost his bearing several times through the flight, his compasses went out because he flew through magnetic storms and so forth. When he finally hit the other side, he was 3 miles off course. So this was just astounding that this could be done. And of course, in the historical sense, he, in that one instant, in that 33 and a half hour flight, shrunk the world.
Now, he became quite a celebrity after the flight. And from the way you describe it in your book, it was a combination of things. It was the importance of the feat that he had just accomplished, and it was also the place that he held within the rise of mass media.
Yes, I think that there's no doubt about that. I mean, the accomplishment was fantastic in and of itself. But it was that moment, too, where radio had really reached its maturity, where we had all sorts of processes for sending photographs through cables and so forth. We had motion pictures. And in fact, for the first time, 1927, they were synchronizing sound with film. And in fact, the first sound newsreel was of Lindbergh taking off at Roosevelt Field. So within 2 days, films could be sent around the world, and everybody instantaneously, simultaneously, could share in that experience. They could actually see and hear Lindbergh's plane taking off. Now, on top of that, he was one of the most photogenic men who ever lived. I mean, he was just impossibly handsome, and he was young. He was 25, and it was at a moment when America was really hitting its stride. So here was this fantastic embodiment of America, of youth, and of all the possibilities of aviation.
The media attention, the celebrity, enormously changed Lindbergh's life. And now, I mean, for people who are always in the public eye, one of the questions is, where is that dividing line between private life and public life? And that was an issue for the Lindberghs, too. When Charles Lindbergh met Anne Morrow and they became a couple, there was an enormous amount of public interest in them. Why was there so much interest in them as a couple, and how did they deal with that?
Well, and again, you've really hit on something extremely important, which, because of all this frenzy after Lindbergh's flight, he really did become the first human quarry for the press. We didn't have the phrase paparazzi then, but it was the first time the paparazzi did cross that line. Even movie stars who existed before that, they were protected by studios, and there was a certain code of ethics. And also people knew the movie stars weren't really the people they portrayed on the screen. Lindbergh was the real thing. So indeed, from that night he landed in Paris, all rules were broken. All rules were thrown out the window, in fact. And he was literally stalked from that day forward. So suddenly, here's this handsome young bachelor who loves his mother, and ultimately he falls in love. It was a kind of storybook meeting with one of the daughters of the American ambassador to Mexico, Dwight Morrow, and this great story unfolded in the press. Everybody loved it. Lindy was falling in love. And he fell in love with a very attractive woman, and she was a poetic woman. I mean, she was really good copy. They looked good together. He was a foot taller than she. He came from the world of science and aviation and machines, and she was this lovely poet. So everything just sort of worked for them. So indeed, the media went crazy for that. It was another thing to sell papers with.
Let's get to the kidnapping. What did you learn from the Lindbergh papers about what went through Charles and Anne Morrow Lindbergh's minds during the period when their child was missing and the hunt was on?
Yes. For me, the most interesting aspect of that period, going through their papers, was to see how it affected the marriage. And I've been told by people who have been through tragedies that it either brings the married couple closer together or it tears them apart. I think in the case of the Lindbergh kidnapping, it did both, actually. During the period while the baby was missing and for the next year or two after that, there was a great kind of foxhole mentality between Charles and Anne that really did bring them together. But after the kidnapping, it was something Lindbergh never wanted to deal with, never talk about. And it always plagued Anne Lindbergh that she never saw her husband cry, that she felt he never properly mourned over this tragedy that had struck both of them, certainly. And as a result of that, she always felt, and in fact a psychiatrist she later saw always felt, that there was this buried trauma there. And it became a kind of wedge, or more than that, it became almost a cancerous growth that got bigger and bigger. And in the later years of the Lindbergh marriage, they were separated for weeks, sometimes months at a time, and never really talked about. And I think, and I think she thinks, that a lot of it goes back to 1932, when this tragedy was never properly dealt with.
Bruno Hauptmann was convicted of the Lindbergh kidnapping. His widow maintained his innocence to the last. And she spent a lot of time trying to convince journalists, often successfully, to reinvestigate, to write stories, and so on. I'm sure you did a little bit of reinvestigating yourself. What did you walk away thinking?
I did, and indeed I spent an afternoon with Mrs. Hauptmann herself, and she agreed to the interview, I think for the reason that she hoped I would join her cause. And in fact, she asked me point blank if I would go to the governor of New Jersey to get him to reopen the case. And indeed, when I met her and when I started this project, it was a fervent hope of mine that I would find enough evidence to clear Bruno Richard Hauptmann. And I really pored over everything I could find with that hope. Unfortunately, the deeper I got into the case, and the more I studied the evidence, and the more I read the transcripts and everyone's statements and so forth, and I really spent a lot of time on all the evidence, the guiltier he came up.
What did you think his motive was?
I think his motive was money. I don't think he intended to kill the baby. I think that was an accident. I think that happened when he was leaving the child's nursery on the second floor, coming down a ladder. There was a bit of a gap between the window and the ladder. I think he put too much weight on the ladder. He also had the added weight of the baby. The ladder did break. We know that. You can see that it is split. And I think the baby either cracked his head against the wall of the house or actually fell to the ground, was dropped to the ground, and his skull was smashed then. So that part was an accident, but I think what he hoped to gain was $50,000 in ransom, and it would have been neat and clean. He would have returned the baby right away.
We'll talk more with Lindbergh's biographer, Scott Berg, after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1998 interview with Scott Berg. His biography of Charles Lindbergh just won a Pulitzer Prize. Now you and I were both warned about protecting ourselves against kidnapping as children, largely because of the Lindbergh kidnapping. What impact did the Lindbergh kidnapping have on Charles and Anne Morrow Lindbergh's approach to protecting their children? What did you get from that, from the papers that you had access to?
Yes, the papers were very revealing in that regard, because Lindbergh was of two minds. On one hand, he was extremely protective, and in fact, he was protective of his family his entire life. It was part of the reason I think he wanted the papers, his own papers, locked up so that nobody could bother his family for 50 years after his death and so forth. But the interesting thing, the flip side, is he was not going to become paranoid about it. And it was as though he was not going to become a victim of the crime twice. And what amazed me is when the second child was born, which was just a few months after the kidnapping, shortly after that, he suddenly took Anne on a trip, a flying trip around the world that lasted for months. So for months at a time, he and Anne suddenly left their baby alone with a nurse or with her mother, sometimes with his mother, but off they went. And it was almost as though he were saying to his wife, this is what I felt rather strongly, we are not going to become paranoid here, and we've got to get on with our lives, and we must just assume this will not happen again. We must protect ourselves as best we can, but that must not change the way we live in a basic way. And off they went. And it was amazing to me that after the birth of each child, Lindbergh did that same drill.
Well, it's almost as if, excuse me for the cheap psychoanalysis here, but it's almost as if what he really was saying was, this time around, we're not going to allow ourselves to become very attached to the infant. We're going to, like, get away and not have this emotional attachment.
I think there's some truth to that. I definitely do. And the Lindbergh children all grew up feeling very loved, but never cosseted by any means. And I think there was always some detachment between parents and children.
You write that your mother didn't want you to write this book about Charles Lindbergh because she thought of Lindbergh as an anti-Semite. And
it was my grandmother.
Your grandmother, excuse me. And therefore, Lindbergh was like not worth the attention. He was a scoundrel, an anti-Semite. What did you find about his degree of anti-Semitism?
What I found was more and less than I expected. And it really became a great exploration for me of what is anti-Semitism. What I learned was that Charles Lindbergh was not an active anti-Semite. He did not hate Jews, if that is your definition of what an anti-Semite is. Some of his best friends were Jewish, as the phrase goes, which is an immediate tip-off to most Jews that he probably is anti-Semitic. But the truth of the matter is, Charles Lindbergh, who didn't have many friends in the world, did have several Jewish friends. He consorted with them, he worked with them, he was friends with them. Now, at the same time, that makes the very point. He did segregate them in his mind. Jews were different. And indeed, during the America First period, which was an extremely controversial period in this country's life, and it was in Lindbergh's life, he did make some references in his writings and in a speech he delivered, in which he talked about the Jews as being other than Americans, as being different, as being another category of people. And in saying that, he really went against the grain of the founding fathers. He really defied what this country is about, which is the great melting pot.
And adding to his reputation for anti-Semitism, in 1937, he described Hitler as a great man. He said, "I believe Hitler has done much for the German people." And shortly before Kristallnacht, he received a medal from Germany, which he never gave back in protest after the war started and after he realized what was actually going on there. Did he ever change his mind about Hitler after the revelations about the concentration camps and the death camps?
He really didn't. And this is one of the great downfalls, or one of the reasons for the downfall of Charles Lindbergh too. He stubbornly adhered to everything he ever thought, said, or did. And it was admirable on one hand that he stood by his actions and record. On the other hand, he never came around. His wife did recant. She wrote, "I found several things in her diaries that were never published, that were indeed praising Hitler, praising Nazi Germany, and so forth." And she did retract them and say, "I was really naive," or "I didn't want to know better." Lindbergh really was infatuated with Germany. One can understand why, and my job is never to excuse him. It's really to explain him. And I try to take you on Lindbergh's journey so that you can see what it is he fell in love with, which was this amazing technological society that was springing forward in the 30s, that had the greatest air force in the world, that seemed to be an anti-crime country and so forth. But of course, he was closing his eyes to the most horrible crimes going on of all. Now, in his defense, there was a lot we did not know about Nazi crimes then. On the other hand, there was plenty we did know. And indeed, he was given this medal, and indeed, he chose never to give it back.
In spite of Lindbergh's many aviation talents and all that he could have offered to the aviation industry during World War II, FDR banned him from participating in any of the government's war efforts. Why?
It's really one of the most interesting things to me, because I grew up a great Roosevelt lover, and I still am. I mean, I think he was a fantastic president. But what I learned putting this book together was really what a petty and manipulative and powerful politician he was at the same time. Lindbergh and Roosevelt became the two great antagonists during the 2 years before Pearl Harbor, 1940, 1941. During that period, Roosevelt very much wanted this country to get into the war. Lindbergh was the primary spokesman to keep us out of the war. And they would give dueling speeches. Roosevelt would give a fireside chat, and some of the country would come over to him. Then Lindbergh would go out and give an address on behalf of America First, and the country would trot toward him. And indeed, as late as the spring and into the summer of 1941, this is now 6 months, and even really up until 3 months before Pearl Harbor, most of the country backed Lindbergh and his position. They believed this was a European war.
America First was an isolationist group.
It was an isolationist organization. When I started the book, in fact, this was one of the great surprises for me. I thought America First was started by a bunch of middle-aged, Midwestern, very Republican senators. What I learned, in fact, was that America First began as a kind of youth movement. It was an organization started by a few students at Yale Law School and Yale University, undergraduates, and a strange conglomeration of kids, basically, who were Gerald Ford, Sergeant Shriver, Potter Stewart, who, of course, ended up on the U.S. Supreme Court, Kingman Brewster, who became president of Yale University. So these were not rabid right-wingers. These were rather idealistic young men who believed, as Lindbergh did, that this was not an American war. Of course, everything changed with Pearl Harbor, and at that moment, Lindbergh tried to get into the war.
So was this FDR's problem with Lindbergh, an ideological one, a political
yes,
one?
It was a political problem and ideological, and indeed, they had had a skirmish about 7 years earlier over the airmail, and it was a fight over canceling some airmail contracts, and it was a very public fight, and it was one that Lindbergh won. And Franklin Roosevelt had made a mistake. It was his first big public goof in the New Deal. It was 1934. And as a result of that, he always sort of had it in for Lindbergh.
Now, Lindbergh went on to other technical accomplishments in the latter part of his life. Maybe you can briefly sum up what they were.
Well, actually, his accomplishments were really all across the board for the last 33 years of his life, most interesting of which, I think, was actually anti-technology, which is he became extremely interested in the environment and conservation. And it was quite ironic because Lindbergh himself realized that he was responsible for a lot of the problems in the environment. He, having been the great romantic symbol of aviation, which shrank the world, it occurred to him that he was responsible for a lot of the encroaching of civilization in areas where it shouldn't be encroached upon. As a result of that, animals were becoming extinct. Some remote tribes were becoming extinct, tribes of human beings, the flora, the fauna. And so he really spent the last 25 years of his life as a very active crusader trying to save the planet. He was very big on saving the whales, saving the trees. He said at one point toward the end of his life, if I had to choose between airplanes and birds, I would choose birds. And it was interesting to me, he was on the Pan Am board, and when the supersonic transport was being developed, he vocally and publicly came out against the SST. He just thought it was ecologically unsound and that it was unnecessary. And in fact, he wrote a big op-ed piece in the New York Times on the very subject. And all Lindbergh's life, he always maintained an interest in archaeology and in anthropology. So there were always, whenever I thought I could pin a label on Lindbergh or whenever I thought I knew where he was going, he would fool me. He'd make a right-hand turn and go in an entirely different direction.
Scott Berg, recorded last September after the publication of his biography of Charles Lindbergh. This week, the book won a Pulitzer Prize. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Bantam Books, publisher of Sabbath, Restoring the Sacred Rhythm of Rest by Wayne Muller, available in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Pulitzer Prize winner John McPhee discusses writing about the natural world. Maureen Corrigan reviews The Hours, the novel which just won a Pulitzer Prize. And John Powers reviews two new French films. We're listening to music by Duke Ellington. The late composer was honored with a special Pulitzer this week. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction was awarded to Michael Cunningham for his novel The Hours. Michael Cunningham's early novels, A Home at the End of the World and Flesh and Blood, were praised for the deft way in which they captured small details that betrayed larger emotional truths. One reviewer even compared him to Virginia Woolf. Cunningham steps into Woolf's shoes and her consciousness in his novel, The Hours. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan loves the book. Let's listen back to the review she recorded after it was published.
Who's amazed by Virginia Woolf? Not me, not quite yet. Oh, I know I'm the problem, not Woolf. I want to like her more than I do. I keep reading her books and even teaching them and learning about her life, waiting for that aha moment to happen. Part of my trouble stems from what most critics hail as Wolfe's greatest achievement, that luminous, shimmering prose style of hers. It calls such attention to itself. I often feel when reading Wolfe that she's tapping me haughtily on the shoulder and saying, "Look at that sentence I just rounded off. Isn't it elegant?" The other problem I have is with Wolfe's wispy plots. Gertrude Stein once declared, dismissively, that the 19th century had invented explanation. I guess I'm more of a 19th century kind of gal. I can't help wanting Wolfe to spell out more of what's happening in her books. Given that I'm not a Wolfe worshiper, it's all the more a testament to Michael Cunningham's power as a writer that I was captivated by The Hours, his retelling, times three, of Mrs. Dalloway, Wolfe's novel about a day in the life of a middle-aged society woman throwing a party. Cunningham clearly appreciates that novel with all the fervor I've not yet been able to muster. The prologue of The Hours announces that all intellectual irony is to be banished from this updating of Dalloway. Cunningham begins by imagining his way into Wolfe's suicide on that afternoon in 1941 when Wolfe, sensing herself to be sliding into another bout of madness, stuffed her coat pocket with a stone and walked into the river beyond her house. It's a well-worn image. Even those people who know nothing else about Wolfe know the dramatic manner in which she died. But Cunningham, with the delicate ruthlessness of a true devotee, takes us into Wolfe's thoughts and sensations at the final moment of being. "The current wraps itself around her," he writes, "and takes her with such sudden, muscular force, it feels as if a strong man has risen from the bottom, grabbed her legs, and held them to his chest. It feels personal." By opening with Wolfe's suicide, Cunningham underscores just how much the themes that preoccupied Wolfe in her fiction mattered personally to her. Madness, the limited saving force of human love, the role of women in marriage, and the tension between rebellion and conformity. Those are the themes in particular that animate Mrs. Dalloway, and they reverberate throughout all three of Cunningham's Dalloway-like storylines. In one strand, he pictures another day in Wolfe's life, this time in 1923 when she's preparing for a tea party with her sister Vanessa. A second narrative follows Laura Brown, a young mother in 1940s L.A. who's beset by forbidden longings, among them the longing for free time to read Mrs. Dalloway, even as she's making a cake for her husband's birthday. And the third story concerns Clarissa Vaughn, a 50-ish Greenwich Village lesbian matron who's preparing a party to celebrate an award won by her friend Richard, a poet who's dying of AIDS. Cunningham has thoroughly internalized the lessons of his mentor. Like Wolfe, he captures and exalts stray moments of consciousness in acrobatic prose that makes their meaning manifest. In his poignant rendering of the inner lives of three female characters, Cunningham also shows that he's cultivated the androgyny of the imagination Wolfe celebrated in her famous essay, A Room of One's Own. And yes, I know it's blasphemy, but I think Cunningham has gone Wolfe one better in The Hours by tying up his three plot lines in a self-consciously O. Henry-type twist that's as ingenious as it is affecting. That's the most striking aspect of The Hours, its emotional force. Literary remakes are usually more clever than they are moving, but Cunningham's tribute to Wolfe in The Hours is so touching, I have hopes that his feeling for her may be contagious.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. The Hours by Michael Cunningham just won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. John McPhee just won a Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction for his book Annals of the Former World, which combines four previously published volumes about the geology of the United States. As William Howarth once put it, McPhee stretches the artistic dimension of reporting. Over the years, he's written about people, places, and phenomena that interest him. In addition to his work about the natural world, he's profiled tennis star Arthur Ashe, basketball player and Senator Bill Bradley, curator Tom Hoving, and physicist Ted Taylor. His book, Oranges, told the botanical processing and marketing history of the ever-popular citrus fruit. McPhee lives in Princeton, where he grew up. Much of his work was first published in The New Yorker. I spoke with him in 1989, after the publication of his book, The Control of Nature, through reports about attempts to control threatening natural forces, a river, a volcano, and landslides.
You're notoriously obsessive about your writing. Can you describe how you organize the notes that you've taken back with you from the place that you've been writing about?
Well, I copy them all first on a typewriter, it used to be, and now it's in a hard disk. And then when all the notes are assembled in this one document, I study that and look for a structure for the piece of writing that will rise out of those notes, rise organically out of the material that I have there and not be imposed from the outside. I mean, a prefabricated structure is not what I would want to find, but an organization, a sequence for the material that I would be dealing with and that makes sense and that yields the best result through juxtapositions of things and whatever can legitimately be done within the context of a factual piece of writing. And that excites me quite a bit, and it might last for several weeks with a long piece as I try to figure all this out and then arrange it so that when I begin a piece of writing, I always know where it's going to end and where it's going to go. The notable exception to this is that I haven't mentioned is that I always write a beginning, a lead first, because that really primes the pump. If you have a successful lead and you know that it works and it makes sense in terms of the piece, that it doesn't promise too much and that it arrests attention in a fair way, then I stop and go back and do all that organizing I'm talking about.
Can I read you the lead from the first essay in The Control of Nature?
Please.
And I'd like to know how you hit on this and knew that this would be the way to start. 300 miles up the Mississippi River from its mouth, many parishes above New Orleans and well north of Baton Rouge, a navigation lock in the Mississippi's right bank allows ships to drop out of the river. In evident defiance of nature, they descend as much as 33 feet, then go off to the west or south.
So why did I use that lead?
Yeah.
Well, you see, the ships are dropping out of the river and going off to the west or south. If that's happening, the river must want to go there too. So we have the very basic situation, but it's presented in terms of the ships and in a way that I hope will exemplify it and make somebody want to find out, hey, why is this? Why would a big boat go out of the Mississippi River 300 miles from its mouth and go downhill on water? There's something odd about that. And of course, the something odd about that is what the whole piece is about. And I like to say that a lead ought to shine like a flashlight down into the whole piece, if possible.
Although you spend much of your life talking to people, for pieces that you'll be writing, you actually do very few interviews yourself. I mean, you allow yourself to be interviewed very seldom. And I was wondering why.
Well, I don't know. It's complicated. First of all, I'm always behind in my work. But for another thing, it's my work that I hope that will be known, not so much myself. I mean, I enjoy doing this once in a while, but I prefer just to publish the material and go home.
Mm-hmm. This explains too why there's
not a very good answer.
Well, this explains too why there's so few pictures of you.
Yeah, well, I think that I don't think a writer should intrude between a piece of writing and a reader.
But you use the first person in your pieces. Where I have to.
If I have to. I mean, there are situations, if you're on a canoe trip with a group of people and you're one of the people, it would be ridiculous not to. And if there's other situations, I did a thing once about an experimental aircraft. It was called the Deltoid Pumpkin Seed. And it was 60,000 words long, and there was one place in this whole story where I needed to appear as I, and that is that near the end, when this thing finally got itself going and was up off the ground, another person in the group got into a Cessna to fly up and fly with it, and I went with him. And at that point, I had to say, I got in the Cessna. Otherwise, how did this author suddenly appear 1,000 feet in the air? And so I took that into the New Yorker, and my editor there, Bob Bingham, said, that's just can't be. That it sticks out like a sore thumb, this I way over near the far end of the story. And he said, can't you find a place at least to do it one other time? And so I hunted around in the front of the piece and found a scene that happened in a Exxon station somewhere, and I put the I in there, and I still regret it. but only because it didn't belong. I mean, I'm not shy to say I if there's no alternative.
We'll get back to our 1989 interview with John McPhee after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with John McPhee, who won a Pulitzer Prize this week. I spoke with him in 1989, after the publication of his book, The Control of Nature, three reports about attempts to control threatening natural forces, a river, a volcano, and landslides. I asked what led him to the subject.
I have a daughter named Sarah, who was in college in the 6 or 7 years ago, and was taking a course from Robert Coles, on the work of Walker Percy. And she was totally swept away by Walker Percy and wanted to go to Walker Percy country for a spring vacation. And I said, fine, we'll go down there, but what's in it for Dad? And after some research, what was in it for Dad was a canoe trip in a brief one in the Atchafalaya Swamp. With an LSU professor and another friend of ours, and the four of us went out into the swamp. And while I was there, I learned that all of the water in the swamp was controlled by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers at a place called Old River, where they were valving the Mississippi and preventing it from going off in a direction in which the Mississippi wants to go, but in which the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers wanted it not to go. And I thought that was a wonderfully symbolic situation of the flat-out struggle between human beings and nature, because the Mississippi has greatly shifted its course down there about once every 1,000 years. And the time had come in the 1950s and thereabout for this to happen. And so they're down there trying to prevent it. And when I got the idea of doing a piece on that and all its implications and ramifications, I thought of doing more pieces in the same theme. And a man at the Waterways Experiment Station in Vicksburg said, well, if you're interested in this theme, you ought to go to Los Angeles and look into the debris basins. And I said, you know, the debris basins? And he said, yeah, they're catching the falling rocks of the San Gabriel Mountains to keep them off Johnny Carson and so on.
One of your three pieces in the new book is called Los Angeles Against the Mountains. and it's about the debris flow. There's a paragraph in that I'd like you to read that kind of describes the magnitude of the debris.
In geology, it would be known as a debris flow. Debris flows amass in stream valleys and more or less resemble fresh concrete. They consist of water mixed with a good deal of solid material, most of which is above sand size. Some of it is Chevrolet size. Boulders bigger than cars ride long distances in debris flows. Boulders grouped like fish eggs pour downhill in debris flows. The dark material coming toward the Genophiles was not only full of boulders, it was so full of automobiles it was like bread dough mixed with raisins. On its way down Pine Cone Road, it plucked up cars from driveways and the street. When it crashed into the Genophile's house, the shattering of safety glass made terrific explosive sounds. A door burst open. Mud and boulders poured into the hall. "We're gonna go," Jackie thought. "Oh my God, what a hell of a way for the four of us to die together."
It's really wonderful descriptive writing in that paragraph. I really like the Chevrolet-sized boulders. I think it was just the right word to use. My guest is writer John McPhee. I've always thought of your style and part as excuse me for this, but finding the macrocosm and the microcosm, looking at something very specific and looking at it so carefully that suddenly things much larger, ideas much larger, begin to emerge. And this one person or one phenomenon that you're looking at becomes almost a metaphor for things larger than itself. Does that jive at all with the way you see your kind of writing?
Well, I sort of hope that happens. I'm glad to hear you say that. but I don't. I think it would be dangerous to sit down and say, and force something like that. You know, you just by attending to the story you're trying to tell, you may hit such a level. But I don't consciously try to do that.
Mm-hmm. What's the longest amount of time you've ever spent on one story?
3 years.
And which one was that?
Coming into the Country.
What was it, about Alaska?
About Alaska.
And you lived there for the full 3 years, or
no,
you went back
oh
and
no.
forth?
No, I went up there about 4 times for visits ranging from 6 weeks to 4 months. And in the rest of the time, I was at home in Princeton, New Jersey, where I live, working on that piece at home. There was a great deal of reading involved, and of course, the writing always takes longer. I was figuring the other day, it takes about 7 days in Princeton for every one that I'm out somewhere, generally.
I mean, 7 days of writing?
Yeah, I mean, people will ask me, does your family miss you? And I say, they're only too happy to get rid of me because I'm back there writing, you know, 7 or 8 days for every one that I'm traveling. And so, and furthermore, the writing goes on. I mean, it might last 15 months, the 15 months of writing. And if you've ever lived with somebody who's doing 15 months of writing, you'd be glad to get rid of them too. And so then the time comes up and I go off for a couple of weeks and then come back again. That's how it works. It's most of the effort is at locked away in a room by yourself.
John McPhee recorded in 1989. This week his book Annals of the Former World won the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction. All the music on today's show is by Duke Ellington, who was honored with a special Pulitzer Prize this week. This is his 1940 recording of In a Mellow Tone. Thank you. Coming up, John Powers reviews two new French films. This is Fresh Air. Two new French films, hot off the film festival circuit, are opening in theaters around the country. Both are first features by new directors and won prizes at Cannes. Our film critic John Power says they're among the best films to be released this year.
There's a kind of movie the French make better than anyone else. Sharply observed character studies that suggest large truths about human nature. In The Dream Life of Angels, Eric Zonka tells the story of two charismatic women struggling against the drab fate that society has assigned them. Elodie Boucher plays Issa, a 20-year-old who wanders through provincial France with her life in a tattered backpack. Unsure of where she's heading, she remains unfailingly optimistic, even when selling handmade postcards on the street. In the northern city of Lille, she befriends Marie, played by Natasha Regnier, a morose, withdrawn loner who shares her sense of being an outsider. But while the sunny Issa will stoically do whatever it takes to survive, Marie yearns to escape the working class and her own bottled-up nature. She throws herself into a hopeless affair with Chris, a cocksure nightclub owner who looks like a Tibetan bodybuilder. When The Dream Life of Angels premiered at Cannes last year, it was hailed as a revelation. In fact, the movie travels ground familiar from Agnès Varda's Vagabond and Claude Garrett's The Lacemaker. Yet that doesn't stop it from being miles better than any of the much-publicized American indies that show at Sundance. Zonka captures the scruffy poetry of blue-collar Lille, showing us the lonely world of the disenfranchised, where solidarity is forever at war with self-preservation. And though his star-crossed finale tries too hard to make a big social statement, everything else is rooted in a complex sense of character, even the love scenes. Marie is drawn to rough sex with Chris because his bedroom violence breaks through the wall she erects against the world. For all its handheld grittiness, the movie has a strange glamour. Cinematographer Agnès Godard bathes the stars in tender light, and Zonka observes even their smallest gestures with an adoring eye. The bubbly dark Boucher steals our hearts as Issa. She's the French actress of the moment. While the tense blonde Regnier gives the exasperating Marie a riveting self-absorption. The two make an enthralling pair of street angels, and their chemistry led them to share the Best Actress Prize at both Cannes and at the European Film Awards. Few movies so realistically convey the ebb and flow of women's friendship, how it's often born of shared alienation, how it can rise to the intensity of romantic love, and how painfully it can melt away when a man comes on the scene. As honest as it is, The Dream Life of Angels looks positively sentimental next to Gaspar Noé's I Stand Alone, a savagely brilliant character study that's definitely not for the faint of heart. It's like a French version of Taxi Driver, but far more honest and incomparably blacker. It takes us inside the mind of an unemployed middle-aged butcher, ferociously acted by Philippe Nahon, who hates foreigners, women, homosexuals, and France itself, which he terms a land of cheese and Nazi lovers. The butcher's whole life is an inner monologue of hatred that recalls the scabrous nihilism of Céline. I would be remiss if I didn't warn you that the movie is profoundly disturbing. It contains a glimpse of hardcore sex, some genuinely harrowing violence, and comes punctuated with the random bang of gunfire. At one point, there's even a flashing sign that warns, "You have 30 seconds to leave the cinema." Noé's use of such a technique isn't simply a trick or evil joke. Rather, his confrontational style is designed to shake us out of our spectatorial detachment, to make us feel what it's like to be trapped inside a mind whirring with the vile thoughts and emotions that most of us have learned to overcome, or at least suppress. The movie succeeds triumphantly in capturing the anger, disgust, resentment, and even misanthropy that boil inside this butcher, that drive him to pack a gun and yet have odd pangs of love for his mentally ill daughter. Last summer, a friend and I saw I Stand Alone and then headed straight to a screening of Saving Private Ryan. As we left the theater after watching all that World War II bloodshed, a Hollywood guy in front of us enthused, "That's the most powerful movie I've ever seen." "That's funny," my friend said. "It's not even the most powerful movie I've seen in the last 4 hours."
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's archive show was co-produced with Kathy Wolf. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Tor Books, publisher of Terry Goodkind's Soul of the Fire, available wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Dustin Hoffman and Tony Goldwyn. Hoffman co-produced the new movie A Walk on the Moon, which Goldwyn directed. Goldwyn's grandfather, Samuel Goldwyn, was the G in MGM. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.